Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday. I believe it's September 20th. Am I correct? Yeah, September 20th, 2018. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. Today's podcast is sponsored by Ancestry.com. With us, as always, Abe Greenwald, our... Abe, what's your title again?
I'm still senior editor.
Senior editor, okay. Sorry. Associate Editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Senior Writer Saurabh Amari. Hi, Saurabh. And
hello, John.
Joining us today for the first time, social commentary columnist Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on.
So we are doing this in a slightly unusual fashion for us. We're on Skype instead of in our podcast studio since Christine is in Washington. And because we are on Skype and not in our podcast studio, Noah Rothman is at his palatial home in New Jersey, whereas Abe, Saurabh, and I are all about 15 feet away from each other, but in separate offices on cute little snowball microphones and headphones. This podcast not being produced today, as usual, by Noah Rothman, but by our friend Scott Emmergut from Ricochet, the place for polite and wonderful conversation on the web. Or is that, I think I got that. I got it close enough for government work. So, so everybody, we have what appears to be a gradual shift in the general perception of the revelation that there is an accuser of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh who says that when he was 17 and she was 15, he subjected her to an unwanted sexual advance that involved some physical contact. Thus, if true, would constitute some form of sexual assault. The story, of course, came out last week. When we first talked about this on Monday, things looked kind of bad for Kavanaugh, and now today is Thursday, and for all intents and purposes, there seems to have been a kind of temperature shift because of the frankly odd refusal of the accuser to agree to come and testify and make her charges public and make the case that this unsupported accusation is true, and then give him a chance to respond. So he's agreed to respond in whatever way. And her lawyer, Christine Blasey Ford's lawyer, says she will not appear. She wants there to be an FBI investigation first. And this, Republicans on the Hill seem to be very tentative and worried about seeming dismissive of her charges, thus being very open to some kind of public hearing that would be a massive spectacle next Monday. And her refusal, apparently, to not only to cooperate with that idea or to appear, but to answer any questions posed to her by anybody except the FBI, seems to have stiffened Republican spines in support of Kavanaugh and the idea that there's something untoward going on here and they should vote. If she's not going to appear, they should just vote and be done with it. So do I have that? Noah, have I adequately summarized the last 48 hours or so?
Yeah, I think, yes, with the exception of the histrionics that has characterized this debate on Twitter. If you're not a part of that debate, then what you just described was pretty reasonable and reasoned and sort of a politically astute strategizing. And that's not been the case in the grassroots, where the debate is entirely bad faith and extremely emotional and has very little interest in any investigative process here whatsoever. In fact, the nominee and the accuser are sort of ancillary to this process. I don't even know if they're central to it anymore. Minds have been pretty well made up, which is why this should never have been made public in the first place. There's simply not enough evidence for anybody in the public sphere to debate this without just delving into their own personal experiences and what have you to flesh out these accusations and make them something we can actually talk about. So what we've seen is actually, I think, a regression. We haven't seen very much progress as far as the public debate goes. It's been pretty unfortunate. I kind of wish we could take the last 48 hours.
But I actually think that that's part that has contributed to the shift that John's talking about, because I think now that there's been a few days of discussing this, sort of as if we all, as if everyone sort of accepts that what she's alleging happened, I think the fundamental injustice of that, of having the discussion on those terms, has seeped in and is part of what has stiffened Republican spines here. You know, there's this sense of like, well, what exactly are we talking about here?
Well, I wish I could say that there was something high going on in which sort of people have awakened to the possibility that, you know, there is an injustice going on in the airing of an unsupported accusation. I don't think that's really right about why the temperature shifted. I think the temperature shifted because Republican politicians may be sensing that feeling is starting to bubble up among their constituents, their supporters, mm-hmm. the people that they need to be passionate about them and Republican voting in November, and not thinking that they're wusses who just give in to every media controversy and Democratic,
you know
talking
points. I have to push back on that a little bit, because initially when this thing dropped, you saw the float from Judiciary Committee Republicans that they would allow their staffers to question Dr. Ford in order to avoid this trap that was invented, frankly, by the pundit class that pretends to be journalists, who said that the optics associated with this cabal of white men would be deleterious to their prospects in November because it would alienate women voters. And they appeared to buy into that. So I don't think it was they took the temperature of their own voters and said, we have to appeal to them. They were looking towards swing voters too.
No, not initially, but I think things shifted some. Now, Christine, what do you make of the optics argument? Because I think Noah dismisses it a little too quickly.
I don't know if I dismiss it. I just think it's awful.
Hmm. Yep. Well, it may or may not be awful, but I'm wondering in political terms, I think the fear that the optics would be bad is a legitimate fear.
The optics matter. And I think part of the reason they matter more in this particular instance than perhaps they should is that we still haven't resolved these underlying questions about where the Me Too movement is headed. And it's why the questions about process are actually extremely important in this case. If an underage high school episode decades later can derail a nominee, and we're going to set this as the standard for how we assess character and ability to serve on the highest court in the land, that's a really fundamental shift. And I think that a lot of the political strategizing that's going on is fascinating, but the bigger question, and the one that's going to have long-term repercussions for how we nominate people to the court, men and women, I should add, because these precedents that are set now are going to affect women down the line as well. We need to figure out what this means for behavior as an adult when it involves kids. And if you cannot corroborate it, and I think that's probably why they did sit on these allegations for as long as they did, and generationally, if what Feinstein's young staffers thought constitutes an actionable case against a nominee because of an assault versus what Feinstein herself thought, these are important questions. And I think the demand for an FBI investigation is not legitimate. This is a way of avoiding the Senate's role and what it should be doing in assessing this nominee.
I just want to make one note, which Ramesh Panuro, among others, made, and he made it very well in a National Review post, namely that to be clear, that because a lot of conservatives are saying, well, this was something that happened when he was 17 and she was 15, and it was high school and so forth. But that's not what Kavanaugh himself has said. He
denies it. Yes,
he denies it categorically. And very forcefully. And he's a smart lawyer. He knows that if the slightest doubt is cast on his denial, he's ruined. And yet they haven't been able to do that. I mean, so it's fascinating. There was this post on Facebook that got massive attention by one of the accuser's classmates, which basically said, "I believe her, this happened," and so forth. And then in an NPR interview, now she says, "Actually, I have no idea whether it happened." Hmm. So the post is by a woman named Christina King, and now but in NPR she says, "Well, actually, that it happened or not, I have no idea." End quote. So his categorical denial has been unassailable.
Right. Well, there's another. I mean, I think an even more interesting exchange or telling exchange came on CNN with Jim Acosta, with an acquaintance of Kavanaugh's in high school named Samantha Gary. So Acosta said, "Did you know Brett Kavanaugh at all?" Gary said, "I did. He was an acquaintance of mine in high school." Acosta: "And did he have this reputation for excessive drinking at that time?" Gary: "I can't really speak for that because he wasn't directly Acosta. What about what Dr. Ford is alleging? Was this the first time you heard anything like that with respect to Judge Kavanaugh?" Gary: "Absolutely. It's not the first time I had heard anything like that in terms of the community of women that I know, and not regarding him, but..." Mm-hmm. "You know, one of the things that's been surprising to me as I've gotten involved in this in the last couple of days is how many women of my class have come forward to me in this last few days and said, I had similar experiences in high school, and this hits me very deeply. And I, Acosta: "Not with Brett Kavanaugh, but with other boys." Gary: "Not with Brett Kavanaugh, but with other boys in our community. And we all feel that if we were in her shoes, we would want to be taken seriously as well." Okay,
right, so it's the consciousness raising problem, right? I mean, they're turning a Senate confirmation process into a feminist consciousness raising session, which there's a time and a place for that. Like this bonding that all these women are doing, and this calling forth for, you know, taking accusations seriously, that is in some ways a distraction from how procedurally the Senate should be behaving with regard to Kavanaugh.
But aside from that, she says she never heard anything like this about Kavanaugh, but it was true of other boys in the community. Now, Brett Kavanaugh is 53 years old. I'm 57 years old. He went to a private school in Washington. I went to a private school in New York City. Now, I can say this categorically about myself, and there are many people that I went to school with who are out there in the ether who could, you know, say otherwise, except they would be lying, which is that I never had a drink in high school. I never smoked pot or did drugs in high school, and I never assaulted a woman in high school. But did that happen to other people in my community at the Columbia Grammar and Preparatory School in New York? Of course it did. You know,
John, you're vaguely to blame. You're to blame.
Apparently, the collective responsibility of men who go to private schools in the late 70s or early 80s is collective and communal. So if X kid that I went to high school with, who was really creepy and ended up going to jail for 7 years for child porn in Massachusetts, I don't know what this is. That's an actual classmate of mine. If he did stuff in high school that was congruent with what he was eventually convicted for as an adult, somehow under this understanding of where we are as a society, I should be given extra special scrutiny or possibly denied the right to have my reputation ruined because of him.
Yeah.
I mean, that is an astonishing standard for people to be addressed, aside from whether it's the Supreme Court or whether you're just looking to get a job, you know, where there's any kind of background check now.
I don't think I don't think it's an astonishing standard at all. It is the standard that has been applied by every social reversal movement since we've had revolutionary social reversal movements. Judge Kavanaugh is just sort of a stand-in here. He is an exemplar of the conservative moralizer, the white preppy boy who earned undue privilege as a kid. He is somebody who is now his own experience is sort of tangential here. It's not even really totally at issue. Briefly, I wanted to talk real bit about his denials and what have you. We're seeing now from the pundit class now several examples of people like Dahlia Lithwick and Matt Bai who have written pieces that contend that his unequivocal denials are a re-victimization of this woman because he's not, quote, taking her pain seriously. And, quote, by calling her delusional, he is making no allowance for the possibility that his own memory is blurred by inebriated youth. It's almost like they want him to open up the possibility that he's kind of guilty, possibly, in order to make the people who are invested in his guilt feel better about themselves.
I've seen so many posts like that. Just saying, look, maybe this incident, but he can just say, I apologize for the atmosphere that my friends and I created. It's like, no.
Right. So I brought this up on Twitter. There's a scene in The Wire, in the first season of The Wire, where the two detectives are interrogating D'Angelo Barksdale, and they make him write an apologetic letter to the victim of somebody who his accountants has killed in lieu of an actual admission of guilt. So it's kind of like that. He's like allowing for at least the prospect that he's sorry for what has happened to him and therefore opening up the possibility that he had something to do with it. And it's a very sort of sneaky way around actually getting him to confess.
It's also it's kind of the Stalinist thing to want confessions that you know aren't true.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very
deep point that one of the ways in which power exerts itself, particularly cultural power, is in creating a culture of confession or of a political reversal that reveals your power by the fact that you force someone to do something that is either untrue or disingenuous. I mean, I'll give you an example of this that has, I would say that in the case of, say, George H.W. Bush and abortion, right? George H.W. Bush was a pro-choice Republican in 1980, joins Reagan's ticket, wants to run for president in 1987, 1988, has already declared himself pro-life, right? But how does anyone on the right really know that he's going to be pro-life if he's elected? Presumably his wife is pro-choice. He ran deliberately as a pro-choice person in 1980. So he had to become more Catholic than the Pope on these matters. He had to be precisely because nobody really believed that he had changed his views on abortion. He had to kowtow and, appoint very pro-life, anti-choice people and give lots of speeches. And Trump actually, I think, followed pretty much the same pattern with the evangelicals. It was like they love him even more for the fact that he isn't one of them, because by kowtowing to them or by, satisfying their political demands, he not only changes his views, but he reveals their power over him. Mm-hmm. And I think culturally you see some of that in these claims that Kavanaugh and other, white men like me should acknowledge our guilt, even if we're not actually technically guilty, because we might be.
And that's sort of why I resent the whole optics thing. I mean, even if that's true, and obviously these members are closer to their constituents than I am, and they know what is a political pratfall and what isn't. But the resistance to that notion is necessary because it is prejudicial. It is just as much a kind of condemnation of a group dynamic, of a demography, as anything else, and that's something that you should resist on principle, whether or not it's politically beneficial.
Right. Well, I will confess to the fact that when this first popped up over the weekend, whatever, and I thought, I don't really care. I mean, I have friends who really like Kavanaugh. He seems like a perfectly he's a good judge, and he's written good opinions and all of that, but if he goes down, he goes down. I don't really, Trump will appoint another justice. His scalp doesn't really matter all that much to me. And then as this unfolded, I started to feel very differently, not because I think that it's important that he, unlike, say, in the case of Robert Bork, who was the most distinguished legal thinker of his day and was denied a seat on the Supreme Court largely for that reason, in my view, because it was feared that he would be too much of a leader of the new conservative movement on the court. But that a terrible injustice was being done to someone for a nakedly political end, and that you're sort of obliged as a decent human being not to let that happen or not to sort of acquiesce in it even in your own head. I mean, I feel this way a little bit about much more minor thing, but like the, you know, the Obama's not really an American, you know, Obama, the birther stuff, which I think there was a point at which there was a decency question about whether or not you accepted this, obviously, clearly an effort to make it appear as though the president of the United States was an alien and a foreigner and not an illegitimate on those grounds, and that there was a giant conspiracy to make him president from the time he was born, and that, you know, this was a serious assault on him as a person. Like, I very much disliked his politics and his views. I don't really think this is comparable, because accusing someone of, you know, having faked a birth certificate is a lot different from accusing someone of sexual assault. But, you know, there are these moments in politics when you sort of, I think you're obliged to acknowledge that there are people here with families. Kavanaugh has two daughters. He's got a wife. Like, this is terrible. And, you know, it's terrible if he gets on the court now, because his career, it's hard to imagine how his life isn't overshadowed a bit forever by this fact. And that my friends and people I know who are liberal will always think, well, you know, there's this, you know, possible sexual abuse around the court.
Well, there's also a strange deja vu here to the Clarence Thomas hearings, because Kavanaugh, like Thomas, has many, many women coming out publicly in support of him, saying this is a man of good judgment, good character. This is not the man that, you know, these accusations are not the Brett Kavanaugh we know. And even their defense of him, forget listen and believe all women, right? They're immediately dismissed. There was a lot of chatter on Twitter about how, you know, supposedly journalists tried to follow up with them and couldn't get confirmation. And it was this ridiculous game playing when these women had all stepped forward and said, look, this is not, we don't recognize the description of this man in this person's accusation. And there haven't been any other women who've come forward. And I feel like a similar dynamic occurred with Clarence Thomas. A lot of the women who'd worked with him throughout their careers immediately came forward and said, you know what, this is not the Clarence Thomas I know. I've never seen this sort of behavior. There's a great deal of hypocrisy in the kind of Me Too moment message that's being played out in this particular script with Kavanaugh. That's deeply frustrating if you're a woman who has ever known or worked for a man who's been unjustly accused of anything in regard to, you know, sexual harassment or abuse. So I find it interesting that I think it was 65 women who knew him, who'd gone to school with him and over the years, said, testified to his character. And that's been completely overlooked in the right. strategizing that's gone.
You know what?
Quite the opposite.
I kind of dismissed that too. And there is this, as I wrote about this, and there was this article in The Atlantic, which made a lot of waves. And I think it was sort of untoward because it imposed on Brett Kavanaugh guilt because somebody assaulted her in the past. But I forget the author's name, but she had,
Flanagan.
Thank you, Flanagan. And in her case, she made it pretty clear that the individual who accosted her had no interest in a romantic relationship and had no interest, frankly, in her as a person. And that, to me, invalidates the notion that these ex-girlfriends and these people who in Brett Kavanaugh's lives can have a positive effect just based on their character analysis of him, because character doesn't matter in the situation in which he is alleged to have been involved. Okay, he's very much in his own control there. So I kind of dismiss those character references.
But there was, I think, an interesting thing that went on in relation to that letter of 65 people testifying to his good character, which is that it was instantly said that there was no way on earth that this letter could have been ginned up in the space of a few hours, that it was clear, therefore, that the Republicans on the committee knew that the allegation was coming and set up this defense of him beforehand. Now, as it happens, on the very same day that this was happening, this horrendous event happened in Israel, where an American who had moved to Israel named Ari Fold was stabbed by a terrorist and pursued the terrorist and took him down before dying himself. It's an amazing story, a heartbreaking story, a heroic story. And his brother set up a GoFundMe online to help defray expenses after his death for his family. Ari Fold was 45 years old. And I went to click on it to donate. And it had been up maybe two and a half hours. And the goal in the GoFundMe was $500,000. And $320,000 had already been raised in 2 hours. That is our reality today. And the notion that you couldn't get a letter together with 65 signatures in the space of a couple of hours or a day in this case, in the world of immediacy and social media was gravely offensive. So basically now any effort to defend Kavanaugh is an effort in bad faith, but every effort to attack him is an effort in good faith, including saying you don't want to testify, you want there to be an FBI investigation, why is this going so quickly? There's all this, they want to ram through, you know, they want to ram this through, right? So we are now, Kavanaugh's, the length of time between Kavanaugh's appointment, nomination, or, you know, Trump declaring him his Supreme Court nominee, and now I think is 94 days, which is starting to get on the longer side of the nominations of the past 30 years, not the shorter side. The shorter side was 19 days in the case of John Roberts, by the way, 19 days.
I want to ask Christine.
Nominated and approved.
I want to ask Christine something about this because I've seen a lot of journalists say, you know, what's the rush? You know, why are we pushing this justice through so fast? And obviously the answer is Republicans want to avoid the midterms. They want to get this done as soon as possible before this enthusiasm gets into the midterm election cycle. They have not said the opposite, that Democrats are quite obviously seeking to delay this process to get it as close as possible to the midterms. And one of the arguments now is that there needs to be an FBI investigation because that's a legitimate thing, not because it's a delay tactic. And before we started recording, you had said that you see this more as a delay tactic, correct?
Yes, because he's already been through multiple FBI investigations. Now, there hasn't been an FBI investigation into her claims specifically, but had there been a pattern of behavior or even a hint of this sort of behavior in his past, that likely would have emerged in a background check. And it also, I think, overlooks what the role of the Senate is here, and that is to interpret his fitness for the court. And I think by punting it over to the FBI and saying as if it's this, you know, neutral observer that's supposed to be sent on these errands by a Senate committee is clearly a political decision that they've made. They've had the Democrats have had this information for quite some time. If they took it seriously, then fine. As when they had the information, they would have started an investigation of their own. Then they would have brought it to the attention of their Republican colleagues. I believe I'm correct in saying that Grassley still hasn't received a copy of the unredacted letter that first laid out the charges.
As of yesterday afternoon, no.
Yeah. So I think that there is a lot of chess playing going on here. And, you know, the queen is the most powerful piece on the board. And in this case, I think I'm not trying to be cynical in saying there shouldn't be an FBI investigation, but it's very difficult to make a rational argument that this is anything but political power playing going on in an effort to delay. And there has been chatter and discussion of it perhaps being, you know, kind of payback for what happened with Merrick Garland and how the election transformed his nomination. So there's clearly a lot of politics going on behind the scenes. Well, so I'm highly skeptical of this as some, you know, good-hearted effort to make sure that this woman's claims are taken seriously.
So, in the Judiciary Committee letter where Grassley said had not received this letter, they laid out very granular detail why this wasn't in the FBI's jurisdiction and why suggesting it should be is abusive. But I haven't seen any Republican lawmakers make that claim. It's almost like they're a little snake bit or afraid to make that claim because there's sort of this understanding that the public won't agree or won't understand why this isn't within the FBI's purview. And you've seen even reporters who know better suggest that the fact that the FBI investigated Clarence Thomas's allegations vis-a-vis Anita Hill suggests that that's a lie. I haven't seen anybody actually go after this claim. they prefer it to be out there for some reason? Why do you think that would be?
It's a trap, I would think, is what they were saying. I mean, you do not.
But they can't defend themselves.
It's very difficult to defend, right? I mean, it's like, look, do you remember when the Violence Against Women Act was named? There were a lot of people who were concerned about some of the procedural things that it was going to make into law. But what are you going to do? Say, I'm for violence against women. You know, how can you be against violence against women? This is one of those situations where, if you're are you going to be the guy who stands up and says, I'm against the FBI looking further into these, you know, very disturbing claims?
Look, what I saw when the accusation came out was almost every Republican saying, well, we got to take this seriously. You know, we should hear from her. We need to know what's going on. We need details. We have to take this allegation, this charge, seriously. In which at which the response was, you're not taking it seriously.
Well, now, and she was invited to testify, which she still, right. You know, the Republicans weren't the ones who leaked her name. They're not the ones who violated the privacy that she claimed to want to keep.
Now, the other thing that happened, I think, again, to bring this down more down to the personal in an odd way, was, so I was on MSNBC the other day, and I was on a very abbreviated segment, and somebody, a former Hillary staffer, said, you know, this just redolent Trump was a sexual. Now we have a sexual abuser in the White House, and he, you know, the idea that he might be appointing a sexual abuser to the court, it's just beyond anything that we can take, or something like that. And I said, you know, I just don't think it's just to start referring to a person as a sexual abuser on the basis of a single unsupported allegation. You can't ruin a person's life this way. It's not right. And the response to me was, how is his life being ruined? I mean, it's not like if he doesn't get free, he doesn't get a lot, you know, he doesn't have the right to be appointed to the Supreme Court. And if he doesn't get on the Supreme Court, he stays an appeals court judge. So how would this ruin his life? Oh, yeah, right. So, like, he won't, even if he's circuit court judge, it won't be known for the rest of his life that he was accused of having assaulted a girl in high school. I mean, so on the grounds that no one is permitted, no one has the right to be a Supreme Court justice, it's okay to take someone's reputation and destroy it in the most egregious public fashion. That is only something that is legitimate if he did it.
The only way
we can know if he did it is for there to be an airing of this publicly, not a smearing private allegation that then unwillingly became public, and we're simply supposed to assume on the basis of no evidence is true.
Matt Iglesias said, I'm paraphrasing, but not by much. It says, you know, oh, boo hoo hoo. So he'll just be a conservative martyr and go on a speaking gig or whatever. So sad, you know. And it's like this is a guy who's a husband and a father, and you know, categorically denies the allegations. And so I'm just kind of reasserting what you said, John. But I also, I mean, one aspect of it is that the most disturbing component, which hasn't been explored enough, I think, is Dianne Feinstein's behavior, or the behavior of her office when they...
Okay, you know what? Table that for a second, and we'll come right back to Dianne Feinstein. But before we do that, I just want to talk a little about Ancestry.com, if that's okay. Because with Ancestry DNA, the leading consumer DNA test, you'll learn a more complete story of you. What will you discover with Ancestry DNA? Find your origins in more than 350 regions around the world, 2 times more geographic detail than any other DNA test. All it takes is a simple test that can be done from the comforts of your home. More than 10 million people have discovered their story with Ancestry DNA. Learn more about yourself and your own story. Ancestry DNA offers an interactive and informative experience that uniquely connects you with your genealogy and heritage. Ancestry DNA combines advanced DNA science with the world's largest online family history database, tracing your ancestors' migration journeys through time. Build a tree on Ancestry, powered by the largest collection of online family history records, and magnify your DNA results for more insight into your genealogy and origins. Noah, you talked a little bit about how you did the kit on the last on the last podcast. You just want to remind people how simple it is?
Yeah, sure. I don't have an update because I haven't gotten my results yet back, but they're in processing and I'm going to have them hopefully next week, if not the week after. I had a kit around for a while to do for my son. It was a gift from one of my Christmases, and I was afraid of it because you have to spit into this little cup, and I was afraid that it was too much for a kid to generate that much saliva. I was wrong. It really is very little. It's a very simple process. It's like two spits. It fills up the whole cup. You put the thing on. You mail it in. It's super easy. It couldn't be easier. I was unduly afraid of it. I recommend it because it is a very simple process.
Christine, you're a Luddite, but have you ever done this? Because I imagine that there would be a fascinating. Your family history must be insanely fascinating.
I have not done it myself. My older sister has done some of the genetic testing, not through Ancestry.com. I actually was contacted years ago by a rather wacky gentleman in Iowa who had tracked down my name through his father's line. But it was very old school, and I think he probably would have benefited from the use of a service like Ancestry.com because he had gone off on some wild tangents and found people he believed to be his cousins who strongly denied that claim. It is actually on my list. I'm a little wary about DNA databases, as you might expect. So I'm less likely to do the cheek swab. But
I want to say that Christine is wary of everything past about 1810.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So I think we should say.
Well, they do allow you to limit your participation in any of these sort of databases that they create. So if you're afraid you want to keep your stuff very private, then they have the option to do that.
Right. Well, I wish I had a more heterogeneous background to make this. You know, I think I'm going to do it, but I expect that I will find, as our colleague Abe Greenwald found, that what I expect is true is true.
Yes,
but yeah, that would be an interesting thing to find out.
Yeah, I'm so Jewish.
You are so Jewish. It should be said that Abe is so Jewish that he actually lived part of his life in a Catskills hotel. That's how Jewish he is.
There you go. And it may very well have changed my DNA.
So
inheritance of acquired characteristics.
That's right.
Yeah, there you go. Well, now we're moving on to discredited science. And this is credited science, so we should go to ancestry.com/commentary today for 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. That's ancestry.com/commentary for 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. Ancestry.com/commentary. And please do this, because I'm fearful that we went in a direction, ideological direction, hostile to the advertiser. And perhaps if the listeners would try to correct for our inappropriateness in our improvising around this topic, maybe they'll come back and sponsor us some more. So Saurabh, you were just talking about the question of what on earth was going on with California, 84-year-old California Democratic senator running again for a 78th term to serve, until she's a nonagenarian, Dianne Feinstein's behavior here.
Well, yeah, I mean, she, you know what it reminded me of, the anonymous accusation without any detail. I think is a kind of abusive politics. I think it's redolent of a kind of authoritarianism or worse. It reminded me, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president, Holocaust denier and Israel wipe off the map threatener, in his famous debate in 2009 with the reformist opposition candidate who now happens to still be in under house arrest a decade after that stolen election, during one of their televised debates, he had this sort of envelope through the debate and he had held it upside down and he was like, shall I show them? Shall I show the people what I have here? Accusations about you, about your wife? Shall I show them? And he never actually revealed. And okay, so in this case, eventually the accuser came forward, but I just think that this is not a sign of a healthy body politic. Another unhealthy sign, I think, is the degree to which so many of our main political disputes now come down to, let's have the FBI resolve it. right? Like every political question becomes a really a law enforcement question. And something is wrong in American democracy, I think, when that constantly happens.
So the timeline here is pretty important. We know from the Washington Post, which, by the way, is a very curious story. It suggests that the Democrats know that their strategy here is failing because it includes a lot of Democrats on background who imply very strongly that the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee is not all there anymore. That being aside, it says that this letter was in Dianne Feinstein's possession from July, that she didn't move on it because there was very little there, that her Democratic colleagues became aware of it the day that Dianne Feinstein released it to the FBI in this very cryptic message, because they said, what are you doing sitting on this thing? You got to get that out there. And then she proceeded to say, cryptically, there's something that's come to my attention. I've directed it to the FBI. In the days that followed, we had, for example, Chris Coons, member of the Judiciary Committee, confessing on television this week that the confidentiality had not been waived by Dr. Ford, that she was still confidential when this was released to the FBI. In the ensuing days, her name was released to the press by somebody, and the only people who had access to this letter were Democratic staffers on Anna Eshoo's staff and Dianne Feinstein's staff. So essentially what we know is that Democratic staffers made Dianne Feinstein leak this to the FBI. Democratic staffers leaked her name to the press against her wishes, and Democratic staffers are essentially responsible for the debate that we're having right now.
Well, and it suggests as well something that's been churning along on the left since the Me Too movement really came to the fore, and that's there's a lot of generational tension between older feminists and younger ones about what constitutes consent, what constitutes assault, how to handle those kinds of allegations, what the process should be. So, I mean, you can well imagine younger staffers being appalled by this and by Feinstein saying there's not a there. So I think it also speaks to these broader challenges of generationally, even on the left, where there's supposed to be some agreement about these sorts of things. There isn't agreement yet on what constitutes assault, what kinds of things should be actionable, what should cost someone their job or their nomination.
But I mean, there may not be agreement because some are more activist than others, but I don't see any pushback on the non-Republican side to almost any of this. And I think Christine, you mentioned in the pre-show a very interesting thing that happened in the world of letters, which is that the editor of the New York Review of Books, Ian Baruma, who's been editing the magazine for a year following the death of Robert Silvers, who had edited it for, I think, 53 or 55 years until his death last year, that Ian Baruma was ousted from his editorship of the New York Review of Books for the crime of having published an article by a Canadian radio talk show host who had been had lost his profession because of credible charges, allegations against him by more than 20 women who had worked with him. This is, you know, years before Harvey Weinstein, and this was 2014 that he lost his job, and it was a sort of personal account of what it's like to be a pariah and like not be able to ply your trade in the world because you had become an outcast. And the publication of this piece led to extreme outrage and denunciations. Similarly, by the way, a piece by John Hockenberry, the radio talk show host in America who lost his job in the wake of the Me Too thing, had a similar piece about this in Harper's. Anyway, Baruma is out. I think this is interesting because the standard now is not only, I thought it was not a good piece, the piece that got Baruma. It was a particularly, it was an ill-chosen editorial decision to run it, particularly because the charges against the man in question, I think are unassailable really. But we are now in a position where you are not even allowed to the airing of this on the left is taken to be something that requires your defenestration.
Just to add to that briefly, from all the reporting that we've seen from inside the New York Times and Business Insider, for example, where our former colleague Daniela Greenbaum had one of her pieces taken down against her will after being published, and the revolt against the editorial staff that includes, I'm blocking on her first name, Weiss.
Barry Weiss, thank you.
Yeah. I don't know why. Sorry, Barry. I don't know why your first name eluded me for a second. But it all comes from the younger staffers, members, not even necessarily editorial staffers, but young millennials who think that the, as you said, the airing of these contrary opinions, or even, you know, the just the discussion of issues along these lines of sexuality and feminism and that sort of field. Is egregious, and that they should be Barry Weiss should lose her job, and that Daniela Greenbaum should be silenced. And that is not the opinion that is shared by the older generation. That is their editors. That you know, it confronts.
Oh, I don't know that it's not shared. Once it becomes clear that they have provoked the anger of the younger, they fold like a, you know, they fold like a deck of cards.
And you know, the what's scary is,
well, Barry's still there.
This
no, but but I'm saying in the case of Kevin Williams, I mean, what we see, is a what we see generally in the case of Business Insider and The Atlantic and others is a and the New York Review is a total capitulation.
And what's scary is this chain reaction dynamic too that that happens. So now, should someone of the left come out and defend Ian Buruma, watch what happens to that person. Watch how dirt is dug up on them. See how their reputation is smeared. That is the total war against a specific opinion.
Yeah, Christine, where are you on Ian Buruma and the?
Well, so Gomeshi's piece, I agree, was not good at all. It was fairly self-indulgent. And if you had followed the story of the allegations against him, yes, he was acquitted of sexual assault charges, but as a harasser, his bona fides seemed pretty strong. So I didn't think the piece was that good. Hockenberry's was a little more interesting, delved a little deeper. But I think the broader question, again, the reason Buruma had to leave, and that Abe is right, that this will continue, unfortunately, is that nobody wants to make that decision about whether and how anyone who's been credibly or not credibly accused of bad behavior sexually can rehab themselves, right? This happened when Louis C.K. did a set at a comedy club. Too soon, everyone yelled. So I think that there's an unwillingness to try to get down to specifics about what we consider right and wrong here. There's an unwillingness to really delve deeply into context, which I think we also see in the Kavanaugh hearings with these accusations. But in the case of these men who've been accused, who've lost their jobs, they're not even allowed to complain about it in print anymore. I don't see why they can't write a, you know, kind of self-indulgent narcissistic essay, you know, whining about what happened to them. That's fine. It's a free country. You don't have to agree with it. You can certainly write an angry letter to the editor, but you don't get an editor removed for publishing it. And I think that kind of self-censorship is going to have longer term consequences. And we have to decide, like, what guys can get rehabbed, what can't. Harvey Weinstein, no. A guy who thought that he was, you know, just being aggressive and coming on to women in the office and then lost his job and wants to start over, having been suitably chastened and understands the new rules? Perhaps. We don't know. We are not even having those conversations. What happens is that a leading man tries to get back into his profession, as Louis C.K. did or others, and the mob decides. And the mob is a fickle beast.
Well, one area where the mob is rather silent is on Al Franken's case. That rehabilitation has begun seemingly without his participation. they seem to be pretty interested in waving the bloody tunic when it comes to Al Franken.
But Al Franken, I hate to put it this way, but Al Franken was their doing. I think we talked about this on Monday, that Al Franken was forced to resign for his party's sake. because they wanted to make sure that in the case of a victory of Roy Moore in the Alabama special election for Senate, that the Democratic Party was pure as the driven snow in the wake of the Me Too allegations politically, and could run in 2018 on the grounds that the Republican Party was the party of that had literally elected, where you know had as that the Alabama the populace in Alabama had elected an actual sexual assaulter and a femophile to the Senate, and then Franken, being a good soldier, resigned, and Moore lost. So that idea was muddied, and if he's bitter, he has every right to be bitter, because he clearly didn't think at the speech that Franken made when he resigned made it clear that he thought that it was crazy that he had to resign. So that's a slightly different matter, I think.
So you're saying that the movement has been plagued by political considerations and strategizing from virtual inception.
Well, I mean, all moral panics, or whatever you want to call, or you know, moral reckonings, or something like that, are they don't take place in some righteous extra political atmosphere. They're wrapped up in the culture, in politics, in people taking advantage, all of that. That's always been true. That will always be true. It's the nature of life. But I think Al Franken's rehabilitation really will be the result of the fact that it will be seen that things were pushed too far in his case. And maybe on the grounds that the person that he, you know, that he supposedly, you know, mishandled was a Trumpian Republican. I'm not.
There were multiple allegations. It wasn't just one.
Well, there was the thing that got him.
The photographic evidence was.
Yeah, right. But listen, before we go, Christine, you have a piece in the October commentary, as you have a piece in every issue, in our social commentary column. Called the identity grift, and I think it's interesting in light of this, because of course part of what goes on in the Me Too matter and these matters is the treatment of being female or being a woman as a form of identity. Now maybe it is ultimately a genuine form of identity, more genuine than any other form of identity, that being male or being female is the ultimate in true identity. But that you detail these cases in which people basically tell cock and bull stories in order to claim their existence as part of a minority identitarian group, and then get caught out, and then it doesn't really seem to hurt them very much.
No, it's fascinating, and there is here a real difference between people who do this on the left and people who do this on the right. If you're a conservative candidate, for example, and you want to pad your resume, you tend to boast about having gone to a better university or having earned a higher degree than you might otherwise have earned, and you usually lose your job if it's found out. This happened to a state Senate candidate in Florida recently, a Republican. But if you're on the left and you're Elizabeth Warren or you're Julia Salazar running for New York State Senate seat, it actually emboldens your followers to see you as more of a hero than you might otherwise be. You want to be seen as less privileged and more of a likely victim rather than the opposite, because you're supposed to stand for all the things that are wrong with the country, not the things that are right. So, you know, I mean, obviously, Trump has relentlessly poked fun at Elizabeth Warren's claims of Native American heritage. But she's, you know, she's trying to kind of clean up that mess she made for herself, and sort of going around and glad handing with Native American leaders and saying, oh, every time they bring up my story, I'm going to promote your issues. And but Julia Salazar really is something else. I mean, P.T. Barnum would have had her in his permanent display as someone mm-hmm. who just spins webs of, you know, fiction, and none of it seems to matter. Armin Rosen and Tablet wrote a devastating examination of all of her lies. Her own brother goes on the record frequently to say, this is not true. You know, we were not raised in poverty. She is not an immigrant. None of it matters. And I think this is a fascinating moment where, in our supposedly post-truth age, even documented, fact-based resume padding, it doesn't matter, because there's a broader goal here, and that's embracing an identity that tells a certain story to voters that they want to hear, and to a movement that wants to have those people leading it. I think it's really disturbing.
So everyone should go to commentarymagazine.com and read Christine's piece, The Identity Grift, which you can also maybe might be able to find also slightly easier by just going to Google, typing in Christine Rosen commentary identity, and it'll pop up as the first item. It's my secret about searching the commentarymagazine.com site is that I usually just use Google myself, and I'm now revealing that to you to make your life simpler, because Commentary, of course, the 73-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads, ask you to subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. So for Abe Greenwald, Noah Rothman, Saurabh Amari, and Christine Rosen, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.